Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform, where I interview military veterans about their civilian careers. Today is episode number 31 with Brooke Jones Chinetti.
Really, it's a full-time job to get a full-time job. And sometimes with veterans, we're bringing these unfathomable managerial skills to these organizations that we transition to, but we forget that stuff shouldn't just be handed to us. I'm the queen of the cold email now. And I wish I would have had that confidence as I transitioned to try to find veterans at companies that I was interested in, or what those veterans, you know, had to say at those companies about what their transition was like.
My top four reasons to listen to today's episode are: number one, cold emails. Brooke gives you a step-by-step guide to drafting cold emails that will help you figure out your ideal job and get your foot in the door for an interview. Number two, stories. Brooke walks through how she prepared for job interviews with a story-centric approach and how she practiced with friends to demilitarize these examples. Number three, timeline. Brooke walks through a specific timeline in preparing for your military separation, including advice on the best time to apply to jobs. Her husband transitioned from the Army as well, so the juxtaposition of their two separation stories makes this particularly compelling. Number four, self-knowledge. We talk a lot about it on the show, and Brooke nails it. She talks about how self-knowledge changes over time and the importance of experience to figure out where your passion lies. So here is my episode with Brooke Jones Chinetti. Well, my guest today is Brooke Jones Chinetti. Normally, she's in New York. Today, I'm catching her while she's traveling to California. But Brooke, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much, Justin. Excited to chat.
Well, I'll give listeners a quick background on you. So Brooke lives in New York. Most recently, she served as the CEO of VetTechTrek, a startup that facilitates high-impact trips to leading tech companies for veterans and their spouses. She started out at West Point, where she received her Bachelor of Science in Portuguese and Environmental Engineering, and she served in the U.S. Army for over 6 years, during which she deployed to Iraq as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom and to Kuwait as part of Operation Enduring Freedom Spartan Shield. She also served as Senior Director of Human Resources and served as the Executive Officer for the Army's Chief of Signal, a two-star general position. After she transitioned from the Army, she spent a year in the financial services industry with JP Morgan Chase as part of their rotational executive development program. And she's currently over at Columbia Business School getting her MBA. And so, Brooke, maybe just to start off, anything to comment on the background or anything you'd like to add about your personal life or anything else?
Well, I really enjoyed my time in the Army. 6 years is kind of a weird transition. A lot of people go like right at five. I definitely wanted to do one more deployment. And luckily I did. That's how I met my husband.
That's a lucky extended transition then.
It was. And, you know, my husband's an Army brat. And so, you know, I'd grown up around the Army. And after we got engaged and, you know, decided to get married, really, you know, we had to talk about like what, you know, what we're going to do as a couple. And that's something that you don't necessarily think about when you're run around and single, like, okay, how am I going to combine, you know, two careers and really make sure that both folks are, you know, being fulfilled and getting what they need from their, you know, career, whether that's civilian or in the military. And we made the decision as a family to transition. So, that, you know, sped up, you know, the transition process for me, and really got to see it from an interesting angle, as you know, I was on assignment to go back to West Point, and going from that to figuring out really quickly what I wanted to be when I grew up was very quick. And I'm, you know, I was really actually fortunate to land where I did with JP Morgan, and you know, great firm, offered, you know, a lot of amazing things with the executive develop program. So we learned a lot very quickly. It's kind of like taking information out of a fire hose whenever you transition. And luckily, you know, learned from a lot of really good people and took on some smart mentors, and hoping to continue to do the same to help, you know, pay it forward and help others as they transition from the military.
That's great. And so it sounds like when you guys made the decision to leave the Army, it was kind of both of you leaving that together. Did you think of one person staying in, or how did you approach this as a couple, that decision to transition?
We did. We absolutely thought about me staying in. I loved the Army. The Army was very good to me. I got to do a lot of really cool jobs, being a part of some great programs that, you know, broke glass ceilings. So so we did think about that. And the really at the end of the day, it would have been his career following mine. And I'm sure like the Navy, you guys get some pretty good posts, but like the Army, sometimes it's in the middle of nowhere where jobs are really, you know, it's difficult to, you know, find, you know, suitable employment where like it's a fulfilling career, staying on a career progression track. It's a little tougher. And then especially once you throw children into the mix, we don't have kids yet, but, you know, as you start to think about family, we really wanted to, you know, make sure that our children had some stability. So that for us was, you know, it did become, you know, we thought about it, we assessed the options, but at the end of the day, the best thing was for both of us to get out, because we're both, you know, very career focused and career driven. So the give and take just wasn't worth it. My husband's actually still in the reserves. So he's still serving. And that's, you know, allowed us to keep a tie to the military, you know, while, you know, having, you know, jobs in corporate America.
That's something I always like to ask about as well. How did you think about whether or not you wanted to do the reserves?
Again, for me, I think it's a very personal question for some people. I have plenty of friends who've either, you know, gone to the Guard or, you know, stayed in the reserves. And like I said, so my husband made that decision. He, you know, was an intelligence officer and he still is, and really enjoyed his MOS. And so for us, it kind of became, you know, a natural fit. For me, it was all or nothing. Like I was either going to stay in and do it all at once or do the reserves. I think I would have missed active duty a little bit too much had I done the reserve. So for me, it was very personal, and it was my decision to not actually go forward and do that. But Mark's been really lucky, had some phenomenal bosses in the reserves that has completely made it worthwhile.
You know, what I'm appreciating about what you're talking about is how you both as a unit, as a family unit, have made decisions on what's right for your family, and whether that's getting out of the military or whether that's being on reserves. And I like that, you know, as a family unit, your husband is on reserves, and there's ways in which you benefit from that, of having some tie-ins to the military and that camaraderie. And it's just very cool to see as a couple how you're navigating this together.
I'm really fortunate. My husband, and that's why I married him. But you know, I'm a pretty outspoken feminist. You know, I'm all about equality across the board and really making sure that we're breaking barriers and that, yeah, as a family, that we are truly a unit, not one person making the decisions and one person following along. And my husband, we're both on the same page when it comes to that we're both making decisions, or we have buy-in. Like, you can't have it your way all the time, but like at some point, like Mark's career takes precedence, and that sometimes mine does. So, you know, as I transitioned from financial services, like we had to make kind of a decision that my career was going to, you know, move us to New York, and we were going to, you know, follow that route. And so for a little bit, like with grad school and living in the city, it was my career for a smidge, but there's going to come a time, like I know, where we're going to, Mark is incredible at what he does, and he's also with JP Morgan, and he's still with the firm. And so it's really, he's killing it. And so I know at another point, like it's going to be, his turn to really take the forefront, and I'll be leaning in.
That's great. I mean, I think we are kind of at a cultural transition point where it feels like at times that our generation is the pioneers in this and I know my wife and I are similar, where we want both of us to be completely fulfilled in our personal and professional lives. And so navigating this in a way where, you know, it's not always going to be about me or always about her, but trying to approach this as what's best for us as a family. And it might be, you know, having grown up in that generation where, you know, at least for me, my parents were so over the top about my brothers and I and making sure we were happy and we got everything we wanted. And so it's just interesting going from that childish view of like, oh, I'm going to get everything I want, to recognizing like, look, this decision might be best for me and my career, but when it comes to us as a family, that's not the right thing. And so choosing things that might not be in our singular best effort interest, but is for the benefit of the family and the unit and for both people.
Exactly. And I think looking at your career as, you know, a jungle gym, and that there's, you know, sometimes you're going to go straight up, and then sometimes you're going to have to stay on, you know, maybe a certain rank or a certain position for a little bit longer, like, but you'll still be able to surmount where you want to and then hit whatever summit that might be. But it just, it's on, it just, everybody has such an individualistic career path that like, there's no right way to do it. And I think that's really important that with, you know, partners and spouses that you make, you know, those decisions together and realize what your end point is, set your goals. But realize that there's not just a straight shot to get anywhere. Like usually there's, you know, sometimes down steps, sometimes side steps.
That's great. That's great. And one other question before we go on to JP Morgan. When you look back on the transition from the Army to civilian life, what was one of the more surprising aspects of that transition? Or what did you not know to expect about what that transition would be like?
Well, really, at first we utilized a headhunting company. And we were a little underwhelmed with the quality of jobs that were and the types of, you know, companies and the locations. Like we really, you know, we were a little scared because we're like, oh my gosh, that's all that's kind of out there. Where I think at the end of the day, what I wish I would have done a little bit more was, you know, reach out and really make an educated choice about what I was getting into. Like sometimes we get, you know, a little short-sighted, like I just have to get a job and I need X amount of dollars, you know, to make and I need to be in this location. Whereas really it's a full-time job to get a full-time job. And sometimes with veterans, you know, we have all this, you know, just incredible experience. We're bringing these like unfathomable managerial skills to these organizations that we transition to, but we forget that stuff shouldn't just be handed to us. And we really need to, you know, make an educated, very, you know, logical and almost strategic decision about, you know, what career we want to go into and where we want to go. So I wish I would have done a little bit more research in terms of, you know, reaching out to people at different companies, like doing, I'm the queen of the cold email now. And I wish I would have had that confidence as I transitioned to try to find veterans at, you know, companies that I was interested in, or, you know, service academy grads or, you know, just recruiters in general and, you know, actually just reached out and tried to see what, you know, was available at those organizations and really what those, recruiters looked for or what those veterans, you know, had to say at those companies about what their transition was like. So I wish I would have done a little bit more of that because you get a little bit scared as you transition because it is such an, you know, a big movement and it's a definite industry jump, regardless of, you know, what, if you go into financial services or consulting or go to get your MBA, you know, it's a huge transition. And really I wish I would have just been as like satisfied with what was handed to me and actually reached out a little bit more as I transitioned.
That's great. I mean, I'd like to actually dive into that more. I think there's a lot of really valuable things you said right there. And one of the things I wanted to dig into is as the queen of cold email, what would you say for someone who's on maybe on active duty right now, who's never reached out to someone? And I agree with you how valuable it is to find someone with a career that you might be interested in and talk to them and learn about their experience and how they got into it. How would you explain to them or what advice would you give about how to do that outreach?
Well, first of all, just not, you know, definitely don't be afraid. Be very, again, strategic with your email. Like definitely prep it and make sure that it's short to the point and catches somebody's eye and do your due diligence, do your research. So LinkedIn is your best friend. You know, you can look at companies and see if there's anybody that, you know, you already have connections with on LinkedIn. You can do filters to see if there are, you know, veterans at those organizations and you can just find their recruiters. But keep in mind that those recruiters they see, you know, hundreds of LinkedIn requests a day and tons of emails. So again, do your due diligence, like look and see what positions are open, and have a little bit of knowledge as you reach out. Like, don't expect them to do the work for you. You know, if you can kind of take care of the work for them, not only does that, you know, increase your odds of them probably reaching back out, but two, like it makes you look like you are prepared for what you're getting into because you are, you're looking and you're seeing what's available. You're seeing how your skill set aligns, and you're coming prepared with questions instead of just like, hey, I'm a veteran. What's available? Please give me a job. And I think that, you know, really it's something so simple, but people, you know, don't necessarily take that into consideration. So I always, you know, prep an email. Sometimes if I, you know somebody there, I'll be like, you know, if I was emailing Google, like, oh, you know, I know somebody who's in one of your sales departments. you know, I served in the Army with her, and, you know, she said amazing things at the company. I'm interested in this position. Really curious as what are the steps for application? And they want to usually talk to you about it because every organization has, you know, a different process. And a lot of folks, you know, if you know somebody, it's easier to navigate the application process. Like once somebody has your name, and you know, you have an actual contact point instead of sending out your resume and your CV and your cover letter to like a database that sees thousands of applications. Like I would never submit an application without having contacted somebody before. And I think really at the end of the day, it's just being very, practical and very, like, yeah, just do your due diligence, I guess, is the best thing before you send an email. Like, make sure that you've covered your bases and you're not making the recruiter or the person that you're reaching out to, the veteran, do the work for you.
I think that's such great advice. Doing, you know, front loading that work yourself, doing the work for them, so it's easy for them to see the connections, to see how you'd fit into their organization, to stand out in some way. And how did that translate then to your first job search? So I'm wondering, from the time you got out of the Army and started the job search, how long did it take you to end up at JP Morgan? And what was that search process like of finding that you wanted to go work at JP Morgan?
Well, again, LinkedIn's going to be your best friend. So for me, I knew I valued brand name. I knew I valued an organization that had a value set similar to mine, and I wanted to work by my husband, and I wanted to be in a big city. So, like, those were my criteria, and your criteria will change. So my criteria now, not even close to the same as what it was when I originally transitioned, and that's okay. But I established my criteria, and then luckily, like I said, LinkedIn, met a recruiter on LinkedIn, shot him a note. Told him like I was interested in the Military Officer Executive Development Program, which is still a fairly new program. And from there, it really didn't take a whole lot of time. So I think my experience was pretty, pretty abnormal. My husband's, it did take a little bit longer, so I can absolutely talk about his process to go to the same firm as well. So for me, I was lucky enough that I got hired while I was still in the military. So I was able to set my start date, do some transition leave, and actually work while I was on transition leave. But the application process, I think, is pretty typical where you apply, you do a handful of interviews, usually with, you know, people who are in the line of business that you're applying for, whether that's an investment bank or in operations. You'll talk to people who potentially are your peers or maybe a level up above you. And then usually if you make it through that round, you'll talk to a hiring manager. And then usually after that, you're brought in for in-person interviews. So for me, I prepped the crud out of myself for those interviews and made sure that I had a story to tell so that it almost every, I had, it was like a powerhouse day of interviews. I think I had like six. And so I was exhausted by the end of it, but each interview I went into and each person I spoke with, I made sure like it was like a story. It was like a conversation we were having. Instead of, you know, making them ask me questions, I was so, you know, forward leaning in my answers, making sure that I almost had control of the interview when I said, you know, told them about an experience that I had, you know, with project management or my leading style. Like I almost guided them to ask me the next question that I wanted them to ask. So I think that's the biggest part, is making sure that, you know, you practice. And I know everybody says that, like, practice your interview, do it in front of the mirror, you know, do it to your husband or your spouse or friends. So that was really big. And then making sure that I, you know, demilitarized my, you know, my career from and made sure that it was civilianized and that folks at JP Morgan understood what I did. I was pretty lucky since I was in HR. That's pretty, you know, that's a global function, regardless of what industry that you're in. But when people think HR, they don't necessarily think of leadership or, you know, building out problems or project management sometimes. So it was really my job to make sure that, you know, not only was I an HR specialist, but, you know, I had led, you know, troops in combat. I had, you know, deployed a unit of 5,000 people. Like it's up to you to tell them your story. You can't just expect them to look at your resume and, you know, tell me a time about this. Like if you drive the interview, not only will it be more conversational, but I think it really makes it into your favor. So for me, like after my interviews, it took 2 to 3 weeks and I got an offer, and then yeah, it was pretty quick. And we transitioned. I would say most organizations like to hire people no more than 90 days out. So it's great to, you know, as you drop your, refrad packet in the military, your unqualified resignation, as you drop it, usually sometimes you're 6 months to a year out. Start doing your research then, start reaching out to people and talk about positions, but know that usually folks aren't looking to hire between 60 and 90 days. So that's what happened with my husband. Like he started looking in May, looked at a bunch of different firms, startups, consulting companies, and also financial services. And his process was a little bit different in terms of how long it took, and that they had roles that were changing really quickly. Whereas if you go into a program, especially like a development program, the start dates are a little bit more rolling. So Mark had a little bit of a different transition in terms of how far out he needed to be in order to actually have a start date.
I love so much of what you're saying here. And one thing I'm wondering, it sounds almost like the 3 month window to separation is kind of the kill zone for trying to lock in your job and actually get a job where you could start if your intention was to start right after you transition. And, you know, not 3 months plus, so like 3 to 6 months out or 3 to 9 months out, that's really the one to focus on the information gathering, the research, meeting with people to figure out what it is you want to do, so that when you're in that 3 month window, you can then really just focus on landing a job within that first stab at what you want to do. Is that about right?
That's absolutely right. And really, I would say don't rush into anything, because like 30, 60, 90 days doesn't feel like a lot of time. And so people sometimes get panicked and might take a job that they might not necessarily want, but they just need a job. I would start prepping and making sure that, you had, money put aside, and so that you can make sure that if, your dream job wouldn't, if you're that's 6 months out and it went away, there's a chance that there'll be another job like that. And so maybe like, don't rush. Like I hate to see veterans who just hop into a job to make sure that they have a job. The churn rate's really high. Like you're not making really to me, you're just not making an informed decision. You're making a rush decision. And the likelihood of people who do that staying at their first job is pretty low.
Yeah.
And that's regardless of industry.
Yeah, I mean, comparisons to dating seem pretty strong too. It's like it feels a lot of times like people have this huge incentive and huge rush to, it seems like it's the equivalent of marrying the first person you date, and it's get a chance to meet a lot of people, learn about yourself, what you want, and make sure that's the right fit. And it does seem like a lot of veterans, for good reason, it's a big unknown, and there's a desire to make money and not to go without and to be proactive, but to give yourself that room to really find the right fit rather than jumping at the first opportunity that comes your way.
Exactly. And also like don't be afraid if like you do find a job and what you thought might have your criteria might have changed of what your job's at, what made you have job satisfaction. And so if you do leave after, your first year, that's not a big deal. And it's not like a blip on you. Like I think a lot of people are like, well, now I have to, like, I'm here. I must, I have to stick it out. It's also okay if, you do find something and you're like, that wasn't for me. And then transition, like that's not a game changer. I think, our parents' generation, people are staying at companies for 20, 30 years. Whereas, especially with, the growth in tech industry and with startups, like people aren't necessarily doing that anymore, especially, millennials aren't staying at a company for life. Like the loyalty is a little bit different. So it's, I think just making sure that veterans like, no, it's okay if your first one's not a home run. And it's okay to transition from that. During that time, like continue to do your research. You should always be learning about what's going on in the market. And really be on the hunt for what makes you, satisfied. Like what are your criteria? Like what about a job? Like what do you need to have in order to be satisfied? Is that a good boss? Is that, pay? Is it a particular industry? Is it relationships? Like, it really is on each person. So there's no right answer, but like, you have to be honest with yourself. Cause I think a lot of us, you know, we sometimes say what people want to hear. And I really think making sure that you're true to yourself during that process, that really helps with job satisfaction.
And what I think is really great to note is that especially in our generation now, this job search and this self-knowledge piece, it's going to, you know, it's going to be something that happens again and again and again. We're all going to be constantly shifting jobs and constantly finding new opportunities. And so the skill set that you're describing around cold emailing, about preparing for interviews, that's not one phase of your life that you do and then you're done with. That's something that we all will most likely do, you know, 5, 6, 7 times, where we, and I liked at the start where you had said, like, the criteria you had initially are no longer relevant for your current job search. And it's true. We all change over life. Our priorities change, our families change, our dynamics change. And so the things that we're looking for will change as well. And I like that thought of being honest with yourself of like, look, this may have been true a year ago, but this isn't true anymore. And so, yeah, I like the way that you put that.
Yeah. So I think it's really important, just again, to remain honest. And I think we sometimes get caught up in, you know, having to work in a, you know, a sexy industry or have this big fat paycheck and you think that's what makes you happy. But like I said, if you lie to yourself, you know, and don't go with really your core values, or even worse, don't even try to assess what those are. I think it leads to, you know, job dissatisfaction, and it might make you even wonder why you left the military. Cause a lot of folks, you know, leave the military cause, you know, job satisfaction or stability. But if, you know, if you're not honest with yourself during that transition, you know, it could lead to regret or, just lost time, I think is a big one.
You know, I think that the self-knowledge piece comes up quite a bit in these interviews. Do you have any advice? Are there any resources you found or structure that you found that to help yourself understand what those values are or what those core things are? What advice would you have for someone and how they could figure that out for themselves?
For me, it was a bit of trial and error. You know, like I said, I thought my values were, you know, name brand and, you know, big salary, you know, living in a big city, like, you know, sexy job title, like all those I thought were important. And then it became, you know, abundantly clear, like, no, like there's still, like for me personally, there's a service tie. Like I have to have that with my job to make sure that I'm happy. Like that is something that I did not know that I absolutely needed. And I think that's for a lot of us when, you know, we transition from the military, you know, that's something that's so inherent. And like, I think we forget about it. Like, oh my gosh, I just spent the last, you know, 6 to 10 years of my life, you know, serving something bigger than me. And then you go to maybe financial services where you're making rich people richer. And you're like, oh, I am missing that. So for me, that was an important tie, making sure that, that was my hierarchy. Like fulfillment is at the top of my hierarchy. So in order to get there, for me, it is making sure that I have selfless service, which is an Army value. Mm-hmm. Making sure that I have balance with my, you know, professional and, you know, home life, and making sure that I have solid relationships, both professionally and, outside of work. So those were, that became a part of my hierarchy. And actually, during leadership and organizational change at Columbia is like really where that became a little bit more solidified, because you know, you're looking inside and you're really thinking about experiences in the past and you know, at what point were you the happiest and at what point were you the, you know, most upset or most dissatisfied. And so for me, like that became important. And so as I navigated, you know, and as I, you know, continue to navigate what I'm, you know, going to be when I grow up, every job I come across, like they have to fulfill that criteria for me. So everybody's values are going to be different. But it's hilarious because the military, like there's always like an intrinsic set of values that, you know, we've all had memorized and we're all told like, these are the Army values. And I'm quite certain the Navy, the Marines, and the Air Force, like have very similar, value sets. But, and as much as you might've just like regurgitated them previously, like once you sit and you think about it, like as cheesy as it may be, that is important to do. So for me, it's what is the top of your hierarchy? Like what is that top word? Is that happiness? Is that fulfillment? Is, you know, that fun? Like make that the top. And then how do you get there? Like what is fulfillment for you? Or what is happiness for you? And really almost build it up like a pyramid so that you, at the end of the day, you know, you'll always stay true to that. And sometimes if, you know, your values aren't being met, the best thing to do is like maybe leave and move on and go and search of those. So it really, those might change, they might not, but like, I think establishing what your value set is, and actually going through and doing the dirty work and thinking about like times where you were, you know, very happy. Well, what made that happen? Times when you were like, you know, really upset with your job or faced a really tough, you know, day at work. What made that so bad? What was violated? So for me, that really is driving, especially now as I'm continuing to, you know, figure out what I want to do, like this, that's important to me. And I think everybody, that's something that everyone can do. And it just takes a lot of inward looking.
Yeah. And what strikes me about that when you say that, I'm realizing that I feel like, sometimes I'm looking for this silver bullet of some sort of theoretical exercise someone could go through that would help them discover what they want. And what I'm realizing when you say that is so much of this is experiential. So much of it is having an internship or a job or an experience for months and months and months, and then realizing, oh, this is my realization. I want this instead. And I think it comes back to your point of like, you don't have to stay in the same job forever. Like that's part of what the job discovery process is. It's going in with your best assumption, doing your research, trying it out, and then maybe you change or maybe you realize something in that. But that experience itself is one of the most powerful ways to figure out and uncover those values and those core things that you're looking for.
Exactly. You totally hit the nail on the head with that.
Well, I'm wondering one thing that was exciting for me when looking in your background was the JP Morgan and Chase, their rotational executive development program. And one thing I like about these rotational programs is it seems like a very efficient way to get a lot of experience and exposure to help in that search. So to start off, maybe for someone on active duty, how would you explain that rotational executive development program at JP Morgan Chase?
I think it's one of the most phenomenal programs out there. I might be a little biased as somebody who went through it for a year, but it truly is phenomenal. You know, as I said earlier, sometimes you're grasping at straws at what you quote unquote want to be when you grow up, and you're afraid you might be pigeonholed if you go into one certain career and maybe don't like it. And sometimes you might not necessarily have the technical skills or the background to maybe go into a certain line of business. So what was so great about the JP Morgan and Chase Military Officer Executive Development Program was that you get to go experience different lines of business. So usually they'll put you in a particular line of business. When you get there, you don't get much say in your first rotation, but it's great because you get to learn how the bank operates and really get to see the bank from whatever perspective that you get placed in. And really, that's kind of the first year is figuring out how the bank operates, what the different lines of business are, how they operate together. That is very important because, again, like in the military, we're just thrown into something. It's like, figure it out. I would say it's the almost the same with corporate America. And what was great about a program like that is it kind of lessened the blow of the fire hose effect of like, you know, just taking all that knowledge with the fire hose. It kind of softened the blow a little. And then really, you know, getting to formulate like, okay, let me figure out what I want to do. Do I want to go into marketing? Do I want to go into the investment bank? Do I want to work with a particular credit card? Do I want to look at asset management? It kind of is what you make it. So it's on you to go network and figure out, you know, again, what these different lines of business do and, you know, what are you interested in? So you don't necessarily have to settle on like, great, I'm going to be in operations or I'm going to be a project manager or I'm going to you know, go into asset management. You almost get to sample various parts of the firm, build out your network. And then hopefully at the end of the 3 years, you know, you're brought in for, you know, full-time employment as a senior manager.
That's great. And so for, so that I'm imagining that your day-to-day life is shifting several times through that course of the year, but just to paint that picture for someone on active duty, what did your day-to-day look like?
Well, fortunately for me, it didn't start with PT anymore. So, we moved to a city. So, started with, public transportation in the morning. So we would, get up, go. Mark and I luckily worked at the same firm, so we would commute together. But yeah, you get in, and it's almost, I wouldn't be, if you came from a very organized unit, an organization, going to especially a very big bank. It was very similar. Like we had a battle rhythm, and I knew what meetings to expect when. And really, to me, it was very, very, similar to the military, except now I'm learning something again for the first time. So my hours, they are longer, and you're working hard. But you do have a little bit more say, in what you're doing, and a little bit more of that, personal freedom, versus in the military. So days were still, long, not as long as they were in the Army for me personally, but a part of that was, being interested in the particular line of business that I was in, and doing reading on the side, and trying to figure out what's going on industry wide and nationally. So for me, that was important. So my days were still pretty long, but again, I think your career in corporate America, it's what you make of it. If I'm sure there are jobs out there where you could do 9 to 5, and that's probably all that's expected, and that's A-okay. I really enjoyed being a part of an organization where, there was a lot being done, a lot of change happening, and really being a part of that, meant working, some good hours, but I really enjoyed that piece. And it was really nice for me with my husband at the firm that we could break away and grab coffee together, or grab lunch. So that was, very unique and pretty special for us.
And what did the hours look like on like a typical week? How many hours would you say you were working?
Well, what was great for me is I got to my desk usually about 8:30 every morning, and typically left around 5:30. But what was great about JP Morgan, and I think a lot of organizations just in corporate America, is, I could log on at home. So if I, got home, we're cooking dinner, and then I needed to log on later that night, like while we were watching TV or the news or a movie or something, I could do that as well. So like I would say, usually like companies, they'll want you to go home, but like sometimes, with anything, like you're logging on at night, and or maybe early in the morning, and or maybe sometimes on weekends. It just, to me, it was, a typical work week, like 8:30, like so, 8:30 to 5:30, and then sometimes at nights were a little bit longer. But some nights, our personal and work life balance was fantastic. We made sure as a couple that, we set priorities and made sure we had time together, and had time to make sure that our work got done to the standard that we wanted it to get done as well.
That's great. And then what was it that brought you then from JP Morgan to Columbia Business School?
So for me, I did not want to go to school full time. Again, personal choice, and it's all about looking internally and asking yourself the tough questions. So I didn't want to go full time. I wanted to work while I went to school, which I guess I'm a glutton for punishment because it's pretty brutal. But for me, that was important. And so when I was at JP Morgan, I applied to a handful of top business schools, and I knew I wanted to work. And for me, getting that technical knowledge, and that business acumen, like that, I needed that. I can read all I want and do my best to try to, teach myself like what's happening in, accounting or in strategy or corporate finance. But for me, I needed to go to school for it. I have a background in Portuguese and engineering, so nothing related to business at all. So I knew I needed to go, but going part-time was exactly what I wanted to do. So a lot of organizations and a lot of companies will allow people to do executive formats where, they'll allow them time off, and you can go to school. Usually a lot of these programs are every other week, every other like Friday, Saturday. And then usually you're doing homework and all that good stuff every night. But that's the path I wanted to take. And so I knew I needed the technical knowledge, and really for me, I'm learning more from my classmates than I ever expected, because everybody has a full-time job, and we're across every industry. We have tech startups, you have hedge fund managers, I have doctors in my class. Like it really is phenomenal to get people's actual perspective from these careers where they're still going to work every day. And you know, if you have a problem that you're facing at work, you can actually bring it up and kind of talk to about it. If you're in like strategy, you could say like, "Hey, I've experienced this," and it becomes a group discussion. It's pretty phenomenal. Like for me, that's the only way to go to school. But I have a good girlfriend who lives in our guest bedroom right now, and she's at Stern full time. And she's loving that. Like, and it's phenomenal. Like the networking that takes place and really the ability to kind of take that time as well to figure out what you want to be when you grow up. So really it's inward looking, making sure that you know what your goals are and what the end state is. If you want to go to school and if you need to go to school and how you want to go do that. So for me, the executive format was the only way. And really applying to school, that becomes a full-time job when you're studying for the GMAT and going through, you know, a handful of applications. Like I would talk to people at business schools, ask them, you know, what their experience is like, go visit. I actually, hilariously enough, did not visit Columbia when I made the decision. I'd visited every other school that I applied for, except for the one I'm actually going to. But I would go and I'd sit in classes and get a feel for what, you know, teaching style they do. Are they more case-based? You know, is it more of a quant school? But again, it's a full-time job to figure out, you know, how you want to do it and what format and then where you want to go.
And I know I would have gotten more out of my MBA experience if I had something to directly apply what I was learning to, whether that was starting a company while at business school or whether it's working while I'm there. It just seems like just my style of learning, it would have been so much more helpful to take the principles I was learning and directly apply them to something to make it much more tangible and three-dimensional. And so I'm envious of that, of your experience that you're able to get. I imagine you'll be able to get more out of the classroom and the community that's business school than you would if you were in isolation or just doing this as an academic exercise.
Exactly, because you're not necessarily just like memorizing and dumping. You are taking, you know, lessons learned and taking them straight to work. Like I said, I'm in school with just incredible, phenomenally bright people who are doing amazing things across, like I said, all industries. And I'm almost learning more from my peers than sometimes some of the material that we cover.
That's great.
Which to me, that's just complete value added.
That's great. And I wanted to learn about your experience when you were at Vet Tech Trek. just what that was like, the experience of running an early stage startup and what your day-to-day life looked like as part of that.
Yeah, Vet Tech Trek. So we were a nonprofit. So that also comes with its own unique challenges and situations. But it was honestly, it was a fabulous time. Like our mission, you know, was incredible. And really at the end of the day, like benefiting veterans and making sure that they, again, were making educated and informed decisions as they transition from the military. So for my day to day, it was very relationship based, you know, in terms of fundraising. And then additionally, like talking to companies that, you know, we wanted veterans to go visit, whether they were, you know, very early stage and maybe in seed or series A, to later stage tech companies. And then also making sure that, you know, we were encouraging, you know, diversity within the space. And, you know, veterans bring such a unique and diverse perspective. And then, you know, there's diversity within the military. One of the most diverse and globally impactful organizations, you know, in the world, United States military. So for me, it was very relationship focused at first. But I mean, really, a lot of folks, especially veterans, don't necessarily get the reputation of being very entrepreneurial. But I would say that, you know, veterans are exceptionally creative and exceptionally entrepreneurial. I'm a very, you know, go for it person. I'd rather look back on my life and, you know, said, you know, that was a good experience. I learned a lot from it. Then, you know, I wish I would have done something. So if, you know, veterans are saying like, you know what, I have this idea, you know, I want to do a startup. I want to create my own company. I always say, go for it. Just with a couple, you know, couple tidbits of knowledge that, like, really, you know, if you're creating, you know, and you're running, you're a cheerleader. Like, that's where you start. Like, you're not like a special king who's in charge of like this organization. And like, there's nothing really exciting and sexy about it. Like, it's a lot of hard work. Like, you're going to be doing, you know, the most work you've ever done in your life while, you know, paying yourself really between like either nothing or, you know, maybe a quarter of what you would make at any job elsewhere. So be realistic with yourself, you know, if you do want to start a company. But there are so many phenomenal resources to really, you know, pitch your idea, whether that's to VCs or through like the Stanford Ignite program, or working with, you know, great organizations like Bunker Labs. There are so many opportunities. So again, like doing your research and figuring what's out there, you know, before you jump both feet in. If you're starting a company, I encourage people to go to business school and absolutely do it that way. That would be my way to do it. But then there's a lot of folks who would, and I know one of my former co-founders would say the same, or he would say something different. Like, he would say, you know, you don't need to go to business school in order to do that. So it really, you have to, again, make the decision for yourself. Like, I would have liked to had, you know, business school resources as I, you know, started a company, whereas some people don't necessarily, you know, need that. So it's really to each their own, but just at the end of the day, be prepared to work harder than you've ever worked in your whole life for, you know, almost nothing. And really expect that to probably happen for a couple of years. And if you're not a technical person and you have like a tech startup that you have an idea, get a CTO immediately. That would be my best, at like, get, you know, you can be the, you know, the face and the one who pitches, but you are going to need a strong CTO. Like, that would be my number one advice.
That's great. You know, one thing you said made me wonder, so having been a CEO and having been a manager in the civilian world, how do you view leadership on the civilian side differing from leadership within the military?
Well, with the military, I think a lot of us, you know, have been leaders. And at the end of the day, you know, sometimes people are just going to do what you said because of the rank on your chest. Whereas in the civilian world, people do not care. So you really have to get buy-in from your team and make sure that, you know, you're communicating effectively and making sure that people know why decisions are being made. Like, sometimes people, you know, don't follow or, you know, don't really hop on board an idea or a project because it wasn't communicated effectively, or, and, you know, maybe they don't understand why, you know, something's taking place. So really, I think the most important type of leadership becomes peer leadership. And then really, you know, making sure that folks who work for you, that, you know, you're communicating, like, and you're telling them like why things are happening, and, making sure that everybody on the team, one, understands, and then two, like, providing buy-in, like making sure that, you know, they have a voice, because sometimes, like in the military, we go so quickly and things just have to get done that we don't listen to all the voices in the room, where, and sometimes that will happen in corporate America as well. But my gut always tells me to ask other people. Like, I surround myself by incredibly intelligent people, and then I, you know, let them tell me what they think. You know, so humbling yourself and making sure that you know that you might not have the best idea in the room is also very important.
That's great. That's great. And when you look back on the first couple of years out of the Army, in what ways did you feel like you were ahead of your civilian counterparts? And in what ways did you feel like you had to work to catch up?
So I think anybody who's coming out of the military, especially around the 5 to 8 year mark, just in terms of managerial experience, like most folks, you know, have managed anywhere between like 30 to like 150 people, depending on what your job is in the military, where, you know, your civilian peers have not done that. And really, I think the biggest part that I saw is, for me in the Army, like, it was my first job in the Army, I got handed like a crud sandwich, and they were just like, yeah, figure it out and fix it. And you're just expected to do so, and you just do it. And I think that's what I think a lot of veterans, they just figure out how to just get stuff done. Just because you're handed these, difficult situations. Where like, I think I was absolutely ahead of my peers in that regard. And then just in management in general, where I think I was a little bit behind was, you know, my peers had, you know, been in corporate America and been, you know, seeing how businesses function for, you know, 5 to 8 years at that point. And so for me, like that's where I needed to catch up. So technical skills. So again, it's, and technical skills don't necessarily mean like, you know, coding or, you know, actually like being a trader or anything like that, but it's, you know, learning how businesses operate, and learning about P&L and learning about, you know, bottom lines and really just how stuff functions. So it entailed a lot of reading and again, like humbling yourself and knowing that you don't know everything. So that for me, that was the toughest part. And where I felt like I was like just behind, because while I was, you know, doing HR and really like being very, very successful in the military, you know, my peers were on the outside gathering all this business knowledge, that I just, you know, hadn't had a need to really have yet. So that was probably the biggest part, was just technical skills. And that's so industry dependent. That again, it's a lot of hard work to transition, and it's a lot of hard work to find a job. So again, it's making sure that you know that people aren't going to hand you everything, and actually doing the hard work of catching up, because they just expect you to be caught up when you transition.
That's awesome. Well, I always like to end with just more of a catch-all, open-ended, that having an audience of other veterans, is there any other advice you would like to provide or things that you'd like to say to anyone listening?
Really, at the end of the day, I'm probably just going to recap what I've said, you know, 100 times, is do the work, find, you know, do the reading, do the research, so that you're making an informed decision when you transition about what industries are out there. Like, and it's, again, it's okay to go and maybe do like go visit Facebook and you're like, you know what, that might not be for me. I really do want to go to finance. Or, hey, like, you know what, finance wasn't for me. I really want to do consulting. That's okay. But do the research and actually, you know, reach out to people and form those, that network. Like, getting that network is the biggest part. You know, tailor up your cold email and really do the work for them and research and reach out to people. It's on you to get a job. No one's going to get a job for you. Just make sure you do the hard work, and you'll look like a rock star if you do.
That's great. That's great. Well, Brooke, I appreciate your time and all the advice. I think this is super valuable. It's energizing for me to hear, and I know it'll be helpful for the listeners. So thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed it, Justin.
Surface.
Thanks for listening. Before you go, 3 important announcements. First, if you believe in what I'm doing and believe in supporting veterans in their careers, please, please, please help me spread the word. The best way I know to do that right now is by taking 18 seconds to write a review on iTunes. It would mean a lot. Second, based on my interviews, I'd advise any and all veterans to look at servicetoschool.org and the American Corporate Partners. Both are completely free for veterans and give you a lot of great resources for your education or professional life, respectively. Third, there are a ton of other great interviews, resources, and data at beyondtheuniform.io. Check it out, share it with your friends, and drop me a line if you have any feedback, because I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and see you on the next interview.